Hi everyone. Before we begin, I want to clarify that in this episode we discuss a range of mental health issues, including depression. So please consider listening to a different episode if this isn't something that's going to sit well with you today. Especially because if this isn't a DMC, I don't know what is. I'm joined today by the wonderful Sophie Gray, founder of Dive Through, a mental wellness company that helps you dive through what you go through. They work with mental health professionals to create resources that help you take care of your mental well-being. Sophie also shares her work to an audience of over 400,000 people through her personal social channels, and her work has been featured in Cosmopolitan, People, Women's Health, Refinery29, Marie Claire, Yahoo, Shape, Self, and many more. Prior to this, Sophie had built an audience of over 500,000 people through her social channels, where she regularly talked about physical wellness. She tells us how it was after suffering a serious panic attack during a connecting flight that she decided to change course, and that's where Dive Through came in. We talk about her experience and discuss a range of mental health issues, both social and personal. We discuss our own experiences with mental health, going way back to our childhoods. So I mean it when I say things get real. I hope this is helpful to everyone listening. I hope that we're at an age now where speaking about these issues is not only accepted but encouraged. So whatever you're going through, know that you're not alone. Please enjoy this episode and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. We always love hearing from you. Hi, Sophie.
Hello, hello.
God, I'm so excited to have you. This is going to be so much fun. I have so many questions that I want to ask you.
Well, I'm always so honored when people want to hear me talk. So thank you for giving me this space to just say a bunch of words.
Yeah, no, of course. I came across you the first time on another podcast episode of The Truth Doctor by Dr. Courtney Tracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Tracy is such a powerhouse of a person. So yeah, that was such a fun show to be on.
Yeah, I was super impressed because I remember her mentioning that you've been named one of the greatest 100 most influential people in health and wellness 3 years in a row. How does that feel?
Yeah, you know, growing up, I was not a fan of, you know, like running for class president and popularity related things because I would never win. So, you know, I think when it comes to awards and stuff like that, I like mentally shut myself down from them. So, you know, when I won that in 3 consecutive years, it was like, oh, wow, okay, I guess someone's recognizing what I'm doing. You know, I think it goes to show the work that I'm doing around being more real online. Like there's a benefit to that and truly wanting to connect with people. So that, you know, is a pretty special recognition. But then also at the end of the day, I always like to remind myself, like, I'm just a person posting online that cares about, you know, health and wellness, particularly from the mental health lens. So, you know, not letting it go to my head by any means.
Well, I mean, there's a little bit to go to your head at least, because I mean, the work that you do is so important, I think. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do at Dive Through?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So at Dive Through, we create mental health resources that help people take charge of their mental health. So we have our mobile app that features a feeling tracking feature. So every day you go into the app, you let it know how you're feeling, and from there it offers up content based on that feeling. So we have journal bundles, we have audio exercises. So, you know, they are either a breathing exercise, visualization, mindful walk, something, you know, to relax yourself or work through whatever you're going through in audio form. We also have articles, and then we have courses and practices. So our courses are really focused on psychoeducation, the things that we weren't taught in school, but we should have been. So for example, we have a course on panic attacks where you learn everything that happens in a panic attack, what's going on in your mind, your body, and then ways to work through that. And then that's where the practices come on that follow up whatever the topic is with, you know, 14 days, 30 days. So like a 30-day journaling program where over these 30 days, you'll, you know, get in that habit of journaling regularly. So really wanting to lead with the psychoeducation, but then also the tools and the next steps forward that people can take. So 90% of our resources are available for free. We work with incredible mental health professionals that have social media followings and just really want to create accessible and easy to use mental health tools and education.
God, that's so cool. And what inspired you to start this company?
So in my first business, I had built an audience of over 500,000 people on Instagram, on Facebook, all over social media. And through that, I was focusing on physical wellness. So I sold over 250,000 workout programs in like a two-ish year span. And this was back in the day, I air quote back in the day, in like 2013, 14, when, you know, buying a program from someone on social media just wasn't a thing yet. So from that experience, I was very much in this world of having to look a certain way. And it was not good for me, for my body physically, but mostly for myself mentally. So I had had mental health concerns in the past that I just pretended didn't happen. I shoved them down. I'm fine now. I'm fixed. It's all good. But the reality was, is I was really struggling. So I was actually in New York for work and I was traveling home. So a 60-minute flight and then would have been a four-hour flight. And I had a panic attack. So on the connecting flight, the doors closed. I absolutely lost it. So when we landed, he was my boyfriend then, he's my husband now. I was like, you need to drive me across like the country to get home because I am not getting on that next flight. So that's what we did. And I had panic attacks the whole time. And I really, you know, had these realizations that I needed to confront what was going on inside my mind and, you know, the parts of my past that I had, you know, ran from rather than processed and healed from. So when I got home, I really realized that I could no longer continue on in the way that I had in my business, in this social media profile that ultimately was really who I was at that point. So I took a complete step back from that and really dedicated a number of years to my mental health. And from that experience, I learned that there was this kind of like two boats. There was the, at the time, you know, in 2015, self-help was really what was the main go-to resource when you were having, you know, air quote, a bad day. And that's not what I was having, but that was really all that was majorly talked about. But what I found is that it was, you know, books on books of basically like toxic positivity of, you know, you get to choose to be happy, manifest your best life. And I was in a mental health crisis. So I'm like, this isn't helpful. Mm-hmm. But then the flip side of it was there was, you know, Psychology Today, Psych Central, these websites that had, you know, so many articles that were very like academic, using words that I didn't know how to pronounce, let alone what they meant. And I saw there was this need for a mental health resource that was both accessible in the language created by qualified professionals. So that is, in a nutshell, you know, how Dive Through came to be.
That is so true. You know, I could completely relate to what you just said because I've had periods of my life where I've struggled with mental health as well. And it that there wasn't really that medium that you mentioned. It was kind of either you're reading an academic article or, you know, I'm supposed to feel better after reading a quote on Instagram because that's as deep as it goes, you know?
So. Oh my goodness, I love that. Yeah, and it's like, and those quotes are totally about, yeah, like I use the choose your happiness because there's so many things that's like, you can choose to be happy. It's like, well, sure, like looking on the positive side is a really great practice in life, but you know, mental health is so much more than choosing to be happy. Happy is a very singular emotion and, you know, people go through a lot of stuff and, you know, we need to normalize that not every day you're going to be happy and you also, that would be kind of boring and wouldn't be a whole lot of fun anyways.
Yeah, I think there's the, for me, the turning point was when you come to the moment of realization where you realize that what's going on inside your brain is actually like the chemicals in your body just are off balance. It's not exactly as it should be. And that there are, of course, there are certain steps that you can take, but it's not just a mindset shift. It's like you have to literally do something to affect your physiology, to affect the chemicals, to make yourself feel better on a physiological level, like whether it's, you know, exercise can help because you release endorphins, or just doing certain things that are actually going to make a sustained difference, that aren't just, okay, this is going to make me smile for the next 2 minutes and then I'm going to get back to struggling with whatever I've got.
Mm-hmm. I love that you bring that up, because, you know, the traumatic experiences we go through in some instances can change our brains. And, you know, that I don't want that to be a scary thing. You know, I think it just goes to show that this approach of, yeah, just think happier, you know, just smile every day, do all these things, are really hollow when it comes to, you know, true mental health. And I also think knowing that is really empowering. And I like to use the example of, I had chronic panic attacks 7 days a week. And when I learned what was going on in my mind and my body and what was being released and why my heart rate was going up and, you know, all of these things, it was so, I don't love the word empowering, but that's what it was, to, you know, actually realize, okay, I'm not, you know, unfortunately, I have to say, going crazy, because that's what you feel like you are, or I'm not dying, or I'm not going to have a heart attack. And, you know, knowing those things is such a, you know, helpful way to approach whatever you're going through.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. And there's a couple things I wanted to unpack with what you mentioned earlier about your first business. By the way, was it just you in your first business? Were you like a solopreneur, essentially?
Yeah. So, you know, I had like freelancers and worked with people like, you know, for odd jobs here and there. But, you know, I think I might have had a team member, you know, for a few months. But yeah, the majority of that time was entirely me.
Okay. So it was clearly like a super busy period of your life. And mm-hmm. I wanted to know, what was it? Do you remember when you, I mean, 500,000 followers is a huge number. What was your ambition before you got there? Like when you first said, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to build a brand on Instagram and amass a following that can help me sustain a living doing this. I suspect that that was a lot of pressure. I mean, you're still clearly very young, so back then you must have been even younger. So like, what was your ambition back then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it kind of, there was, I guess, kind of two parts to it. So when I had started posting on Instagram, and for people listening, like it was a completely different world. Like the idea of an influencer didn't exist. That just wasn't a thing. You know, people setting out to be Instagram famous, social media famous also was not a thing. So when I was posting on the channel, I'd started, you know, using it to document a modeling career that I wanted to have and never did. And through that, I started to talk about, you know, what I was doing for working out, what I was eating, and sharing, you know, what I was doing. That it was called Way of Gray. I was like showing the way of my life. And there was this interest, and I didn't understand why. Now I do. You know, I was a thin white woman that, you know, unfortunately, that's what people care most about, particularly in that time. And from that, I started to kind of snowball. I believe I got to like 10,000 followers. And at the same time, I had bought a recipe guide from a food blogger. And I was like, oh, like, this is really cool. Like, I want to do this. So then it was very laser focused. I'd always been very entrepreneurial growing up. I always knew it was something I was going to do. I like to say I'm like unemployable. I always butted head with managers, and I just, yeah, wasn't the best person to have as an employee. So from that, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it in fitness. So I went and I got a certification. But then I always worked with mental health professionals, other professionals on the workout programs themselves. So they would be the experts. I would then put be the face of them. And then it got, yeah, very, you know, targeted and focused on growth. Back in the time when Instagram was the Wild West, there wasn't, you know, the articles about, you know, how to build a social media following as there is today. So I think for me, the ambition came from, I was very motivated by growth, particularly financial growth, which, you know, now I look back, I think, you know, that can be healthy. But for me in that business, it was not healthy. It was very much tied into my identity. But I wanted to grow a massive business. And, you know, that is a version of what I did. But the reality was that, you know, the pain it was causing on my mental health just wasn't at all sustainable.
Yeah, because I mean, when, like you said, it's a business that is directly tied to your persona. So it does almost feel like a part of your identity. Like also with modeling, it's like, I assume obviously that's only a part of who that person is, but that's the entirety of their... I don't know how to explain this. Like, let's take Simone Biles and what happened in the Olympics, for example. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people, thankfully, thought that what she did and the way that she backed down was so brave. But then there was also backlash from so many people who were just like, she's an athlete, she should be able to deal with it. And it's like, it's almost as though people didn't understand that being an athlete is only a part of her person. Like, she's, you know, people aren't unidimensional, but when you're an athlete, you're seen as an athlete. When you're a model, you're seen as a model. It's like, as soon as there's rejection, or I don't know, you lose a race or you don't get a particular gig or whatever, it can affect you to such a greater extent in a way, because it's not like you're part of a company, it's just you are your brand and that is you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I feel very passionate about this topic in the, you know, the lens of influencers in particular, which isn't something I would ever identify as, or even content creator, you know, maybe in my past life, but that those, again, just weren't terms then. It it's really difficult for both sides. And I believe in accountability as both the person posting, but then also the person consuming those posts. And it's very difficult, I think, for a lot of creators to separate, you know, themselves from this channel. And especially when you're starting so young, you know, I was fresh out of high school. I had all of these problems in my young childhood and into my teen years that I didn't process, because then I blew up on social media and it was like this replacement. You know, even looking at modeling, my motivations to want to be a model were the exact same as I wanted to be accepted. I wanted approval and validation. And then I got that through social media. So it was just like, okay, this didn't work here, then I'm just going to move on here. And, you know, that is unhealthy for everyone. But then when you bring in, yeah, this following that expects you to be X, Y, and Z, you know, that is really harmful. And that's, again, why it goes both ways. So I don't love when we see people ragging on influencers. It's like, well, society, which you and I are a part of, create what's popular. We create what we want to consume. And, you know, that's predominantly perfection and, you know, curation, something that's actually not realistic or real. But then we also expect that person to be real. So it's like you think you're getting who this person is. You're like, this is exactly who they are, you know, defining them by these this box on social media. But that's, you know, how could you reduce and boil down a person to that? So it's just this, you know, one day maybe I'll lecture on it at a, you know, a college, because it's just, it's such a, you know, weird dynamic. I know they comment of like parasocial relationships. And we see that is like John Mulaney, that to me is like the comedian is like the most wild example of how people have formed who he is in his their mind. And he just came out of rehab and now got a divorce and all of these things and the commentary, because they expected him to be one thing, but he's a human. Therefore, he makes mistakes and then does multiple things. But we don't seem to allow people that grace or that space to do so in, you know, all these sorts of settings.
That is so interesting. I mean, whenever you hear about the social media debate, you know, is social media good or bad? It's always someone arguing pro social media because it gives people freedom of expression versus someone arguing, you know, and arguing that it's the consumer's responsibility to kind of know what's valid and what's not. And then the other side, from the consumer's perspective, you never actually think, actually, what is society doing to make people feel like they have to present themselves in a certain way on social channels in the first place? Like, it's a lot of socialization that makes those influencers or people's feeds come out a particular way, because that's what we're saying. This is valid. If you post this, this is, you know, you're going to be validated. It's kind of validation seeking in a sense. And you said something on the podcast actually that I listened to, which was super interesting, because you equated, you know, you equated exercise to self-harm. You said that it was kind of a way of doing intense exercise is in itself a form of self-harm. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah. So, you know, of course, anyone listening, you know, not exercise isn't self-harm for everyone, but just like anything you can do to an excess, that's what exercise was for me. And it was this channel to try to solve all of my problems through looking a certain way. And, you know, it's something that I you know, transparently haven't, you know, even known how to recover in the relationship that I have with exercise because it was so bad. But yeah, I was using exercise as this tool of punishment and of debasing my body, basically, of like, you need to do X each day. You need to look like this. I need to, again, kind of shove myself into, you know, the own box of my body being significantly thinner than it is. Like, I think right now I'm sitting maybe 30 or almost 40 pounds heavier than I was at my peak in social media. And, you know, what comes with that weight is absolute freedom of not being, you know, chained to looking a certain way and then having that very unhealthy relationship with exercise. So again, you know, not everyone will have that experience with working out, but that definitely was just a way for me to control myself when I definitely felt, I guess, very out of control in other areas of my life, really channeled that, you know, that need into exercise.
Okay. Do you think it's because you could see progress? So it was like you set yourself certain milestones. You're like, yeah, I got to this weight.
Yeah. And like, I think, you know, again, the control point is, you know, in life, you know, there's a lot that is in our control, but, you know, there's a lot that isn't. And I really struggle with that. I always used to think that a control freak, I don't love that word, but was like Monica, I was saying her last name at the same time, Monica Geller on Friends, and how she was very like cleaning and then like, you know, making people do certain things and were very controlling outward to other people. But I realized for me, my control issues are like entirely reflected in. Like, I'm very casual and easygoing with other people, but I, you know, hold myself. I feel like I'm like crunching on a pop can at all times, like in my chest. And exercise was a way for me to direct that energy because that was something I had control over. But then, of course, you know, it went too far and yeah, turned into just something, yeah, as a way for me to be able to see that, yeah, that physical result and see the, you know, the result of my control, which just, you know, is not healthy.
Yeah. Do you remember at any point, like, what was it that made you feel like that was the element that was going to make you better in a way? What was it you think that made you feel like, if I'm skinnier, I'm just, people will like me more. I'll be a better person.
Yeah. So I really think, you know, coming back to the aspirations that I had in modeling, you know, when I was 15, I remember spending so much time Googling every single Victoria's Secret model. I knew all of their measurements. I knew, you know, what their bust was, their waist, their hips. And I wanted that. I wanted to get my body down to those measurements. So I had that very specific goal. But, you know, the reality is like when you have, like, hips aren't something that can physically go down to a certain point. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, was really, like, really tormented me. But yeah, it was really from that experience that I was like, okay, like, you know, you see these models, everyone loves them. Mm-hmm. Therefore, is it because they look this way? Okay, then that's what I'm going to do. That's what I want. So I think really it was seeing that, you know, as a child, and, you know, when you kind of put that in your brain and then you just latch on and that's the truth now. And that was a truth that, I carried into my early 20s.
Wow. Do you begin to feel that way in high school or like even younger? Because you mentioned that, you know, growing up, you struggled with mental health issues. Did it stem back then?
Yeah. So from the body image came later. Elementary, I had this bullying experience. And, you know, there's even still part of me, like, I'm 27 now, that has, I'm almost like embarrassed, you know, referring to it. But my mom brings it up almost every week, that this experience was so severe. She was like, this like changed who you were. And it took me a very long time to like get back to that person or that, you know, that path that I was on before that. So this experience, you know, teachers were involved. There was like a lot of intervention. So this like was severely bullied. And then I feel like that pushed me into this need to confine and to pare down who I was. And I think, you know, unfortunately, we all learn that at some point in childhood. And I had a lot of pain from this experience. And then, you know, into junior high, you know, grade 7, grade 8, grade 9, I struggled with self-harm. So that was another way to control how I was feeling. I had, you know, as a child does, you know, you have, you know, problems with friends, you have problems with little boys. And, you know, it was never about that. But what it was about was my inability to control those out like exterior factors that were making me feel bad. So for me, I thought self-harm was the appropriate way to navigate that. So that was, you know, a version of the control. And then in high school, that's when I remember, like, you know, being younger and having friends that had body image problems, like when we were 12 and 13, and it just never had crossed my mind. And I was like, I never, like, you're working out already. Like, we're children. Like, you know, we play sports. We don't need to do this. And then it was, yeah, in high school, we had a gym in the school with a full-time trainer. And that's when I really started to, you know, want to be focusing on working out and eating a certain way and, you know, dieting and all of that. And I remember in the gym, they had a tape measure and I would come and run into the gym every day almost and take measurement of my body. So I, you know, when I look back on my life, I feel like I had these themes of control of, I just, you know, it was different outlets, pushing it into a different outlet. The exercise then morphed into the business side of things where, you know, it was these visible ways of success. It was this visible way to be like, well, if I look this certain way, or if I have this success in my business, then I won't have these problems. And, you know, that's not how it works, is what I learned.
Wow. What you mentioned about changing when you were younger, that event being so traumatic in a sense, and maybe another child wouldn't have necessarily reacted in the same way, but the fact that it, you know, changed who you were. Like, how would you contrast the person that you were before that event to the person mm-hmm. who you became after that event?
Yeah. So, you know, of course, when you're a child, like what this, I would have been 10, maybe like 10. Yeah, I think that age, you know, of course, you know, you're more free going. I think every child is to a degree, but I would say I was over the top and just so fun. So, you know, outgoing and so like such a big personality. And you know, I think it's came fuller circle for me. My niece, she just turned 5, and she is truly like the funniest child. Like, not like child funny, like as an adult, you're like, that's actually a really good joke. And she is just has this big personality and is just like this, like the center of attention, but like not forcefully, like very naturally. And I think, you know, my mom will reference like seeing a lot of that, you know, that I was like that as well. And I think, you know, that experience then entered the self-doubt, because I think we all have an experience like this. You know, mine came from peers. Unfortunately, some might come from their parents or their lack of, you know, that parental figure in their life, or, you know, some other experience that they face. So for me, I think it really, yeah, it taught me to pare down who I was, and that, you know, that inner light, if we want to refer to that. And, you know, even this feels like it's bragging. And I think, you know, that's unfortunately like the, you know, the reality of life is there's a part of us that gets dimmed and kind of like, I don't want to say beaten down in a way. But yeah, that was the experience for me. So, you know, I think coming back to that, I think even, you know, these days, I would say I mirror more of that child than I had, you know, for the previous years.
You know, I can really relate. And for me, there wasn't a specific event, but I do remember there is one specific person that stands out in my mind. And like, I don't think she meant it at all intentionally. But one of my aunties, I remember her. It wasn't even just like a one-time thing. It was like, just, I remember being intimidated by her because she would judge me. Like, I felt I was quite, outgoing, and I used to love to dance and sing and put on a play with my cousins and kind of organize the whole shebang in the living room and make everyone watch in the evening. And I remember, you know, just her making comments being like, oh, and this was even younger. I was probably like 5, 6, because then we came to England when I was almost 9. So this was definitely under the age of 8, let's say, because we're originally from Spain. And my aunt was, you know, she'd always be like, oh, she's really bossy. She's so, you know, she's so this, she's so that. And I listened to, again, a podcast, and I read her book, actually, Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. And I could so relate to the things that she was saying, because she said, and it's true, like when, say you've got a, I don't know, a 5-year-old girl and a 5-year-old boy, and the 5-year-old boy takes charge or takes control of a situation, people are like, oh, he's a leader. Whereas the girl does it, and they do the exact same thing, but the girl will be, you know, almost laughed at, or it'll be like, oh, how cute, look, she's so bossy. And it's like, it's almost downplayed when it's particularly for girls. And those kind of traits are, I think, valued more when it's associated to a little boy, which, to be honest, like the pressure for men can work both ways, because some little boys just aren't like that, and they shouldn't be made to feel less than just because they're not particularly authoritative or loud or take control of a situation. That's also fine. So I do think it works both ways, but that's one of the reasons why I loved what you do at Dive Through, because when you go on your website, you see that all of your, you know, your services and the products that you offer, they're all so all encompassing. It's like it recognizes that mental health touches on so many aspects of your life, whether it's relationships, sexuality, you know, just parenthood, your physical health as well. It's all inextricably linked. And I think that in the same way that your mental health is affected by all of the aspects of who you are today, it also really is affected by your past. And sometimes you need to reflect on, you know, why is it that I feel this way, and what could have been the things that happened, maybe even as back as my childhood, that informed the way that I'm acting or behaving or feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, thank you for sharing that story. And it's wild to think how early on women are, you know, as young girls are taught how to behave. That is like, you know, this is what a woman's like. And, you know, it's indirect, which is just like so heartbreaking. But then it's so wonderful to see all the progress we've made, particularly as of late, and, you know, having resources available to, you know, make sure that you're not teaching your daughter or your son or your child those sorts of, I guess, you know, stereotypes. And, you know, touching on, you know, at Dive Through, we believe mental health is so much more than being stressed and being anxious. And we really believe that there also, you know, you have your individual mental health, but then there's also the collective, you know, experience that contributes to other people's mental health. So for example, we have resources available on, you know, using pronouns, understanding the different spectrums of sexuality, you know, trans people's lived experiences, non-binary. We even have, you know, topics around anti-fat bias and fat phobia, because when, you know, you learn about those things as a straight size person or as a cisgendered person, you can, you know, help the mental health of those people and those lived experiences. And there's that, I think, that duty to one another to work on, you know, of course ourselves, but then also on, you know, being able to, just because you haven't lived an experience doesn't mean you can't, you know, be mindful of it and, you know, make actions towards, you know, reducing the stress and burden on those people people in that experience. So, you know, that I think is a larger lens of mental health, which, you know, I don't necessarily like to put like the social justice side on it, but I think that is a mental health concern. And we have, again, like that duty to other people to, you know, care about one another, which is so important.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think sometimes that can be missed, because obviously sometimes we can't always identify how people are feeling. But again, to put a female spin on it, but there's an episode on the I Weigh podcast with Jamila Jamil and Elizabeth Banks, and they talk about periods and how oftentimes they're ridiculed, or even, you know, in the media that or on TV or whatever. We've all heard the "is it your time of the month" joke. And it's like, oh, you're visibly cranky, you're visibly angry, you're visibly emotional. And for women, maybe there are certain times of the month where it is more visible. Like, I have a pretty clear, you know, the day before I come on, I am going to be needy. I want to be near you. I don't want to be touched by you, but I can't be alone. And I'm probably going to cry at some point. And so, yes, there are certain biological explanations. And it's not an excuse. It doesn't mean, you know, I can't snap at someone or be angry at someone. But I do think there does need to be a heightened level of compassion where it's like, these are literally chemical reactions happening in our bodies. And it doesn't excuse how I behave towards you, but like, I'm going to need a little compassion from you today. And I think that that applies to everyone generally, men and women, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, compassion and understanding for other people and then also for yourself. I like, you know, self-compassion is such a beautiful thing when it comes to mental health. And just, I think, yeah, like leading with compassion outside of yourself and inward as well.
Yeah. And I wanted to touch on one last thing because I do think it is very important. Obviously, there are a lot of things that we can do when we're struggling with our mental health that can help, so that you can exercise, socialize, walk in nature, avoid alcohol are some of the things that come to mind. And whilst it's not a decision to be made lightly, there is a pronounced stigma about the use of antidepressants. And I think some people feel really ashamed to use them, or to admit that they use them, or to even consider them. Some people completely are like, I'm not, you know, those are for crazy people. I wouldn't ever take an antidepressant. What's your opinion?
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, I liken it to if you have a broken bone, that's maybe not the best example. Say that you have high blood pressure. You need medication. Like, you're not questioning that. Is that shameful? If needing medication for your blood pressure or for anemia or for some other sort of physical ailment isn't shameful, why are needing medication for depression, anxiety, and such? You know, there is literally no difference. There isn't, you know, physical health and mental health is health. You know, it's unfortunate we have to separate them, but, you know, we're just coming around to the idea of mental health. And why choose the suffering? If we can take something that has all of the studies, all of, you know, the research that's been done, and it can help us, why not? The one thing I would say is always, you know, when it comes to medication, being a active participant in your mental health journey by, you know, using that medication and going to therapy if, you know, financially possible. Then also journaling, exercising, breathing exercise, practicing mindfulness. So, you know, knowing that medication isn't the end point and the only point, it's not the only point. It could also be, you know, the last step in your journey, and that's okay. I think when you know you're doing it with multiple things going on, I think that's really great. And yeah, you know, it's taking something for your brain is no different from taking something for your kidney or for your throat or whatever it might be. And, you know, it's really beautiful and it's a privilege to be able to get that support. So there doesn't need to be any shame around it.
Yeah, I completely agree with your perspective. And actually, you made me think of something, because I think a lot of people struggle to maybe see the chicken and the egg complexity to this. So it's like when you mentioned the broken bone, we find it very easy to explain a broken bone. And, you know, you're at A and you know what you have to do to get to B. It's like you have to put a cast on and you know that your bone will repair itself. It's not supposed to be that way, kind of thing. And with blood pressure, okay, so if it's high, you want it lower. If it's low, you want it higher. There's like a very clear, we want to get from A to B. Whereas when it comes to our mental health, it's very much more cyclical. Like, it's not necessarily
your mind affecting your mood or your body, it's also your body affecting your mind. And there is an element to that that you can control, but there's also going to be an element that you can't. Like, very often it's hormonal. And, you know, sometimes, say someone has an issue with their thyroid, like if they have an underactive thyroid, those people, you know, that's hormonal. And those people have to be on medication for life in order to be able to live properly. And so it's kind of the same. Like, antidepressants might not necessarily be a lifetime thing, although I do know that for some people that it is. But yeah, it is very much just like a balance of hormones that you can't necessarily affect once it gets past a certain point without medication. And I don't think there's, you know, any shame in that. I don't think it means that you're weak because you couldn't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, you know, when a bone is broken, we get that this bone is broken. Whereas when it comes to your mental health, unless there was like, you know, there's different, you know, experiences and why you reach for medication, but say that it's been something your whole life. So it wasn't like an event that happened that you then had this depression episode or whatever it might be. If you've always had a lower mood, you won't know how severe it might be, how on the other side you can feel. You know, I liken it to, I just was diagnosed with ADHD. And while I'm not on medication yet, I'm like going back and looking at my whole life and I'm like, oh, so I wasn't supposed to struggle with this, this, and this. My mind isn't supposed to work like this. But I had no idea because I didn't have the tool and the language to communicate what I was feeling, because I thought everyone was experiencing that. So I think also it's just not as black and white as a broken bone is. Mm-hmm. And that's where talking about it. And that is where, you know, I'm the biggest, you know, promoter of therapy. I just, you know, makes me so sad that it's not an accessible form of healthcare. But, you know, being able to talk to a therapist, explain how you're feeling, it's never about comparing, but, you know, it's hard if you don't know where the starting line for someone else is. But if your start line is so much further back, like, of course, life is going to be, you know, so much more difficult. But if you can take something that can get you, you know, somewhere close to, you know, where other people are starting, that is such a gift and so great. And yeah, again, no shame around that.
Yeah. And I've the exact same thing has happened to me, except like I struggled with depression. And there was one year where it was very particularly pronounced. And it was, you know, it was just unavoidable. There was like no question. I was like, okay, yeah, this is depression. But then I started to think back and, you know, I started to try and self-help initially, and I started to read a lot about it, a lot of books and stuff. And there is a genetic component to it. And I started to find out from speaking to people that there had been other members of my family who had also suffered from depression. And I started to think, okay, so that's why. But then it made me think back, like you were saying, I identified certain moments throughout my childhood, throughout my teen years especially, and I started to think, wow, like I was probably at other times, like this is probably what it was. It didn't last for a year, and so maybe I didn't necessarily identify it, but that wasn't necessarily normal. Like the things that I felt, it's not that I wasn't supposed to be feeling it. That's not the right thing to say, but it wasn't, you know, life could have been better had I potentially identified those issues earlier. And that's where, for me, I recognize that could have been a reason why sometimes I think I held a lot of resentment towards my parents, because I almost felt as though, yes, I was a little brat when I was a teenager, but the reason why I wasn't very nice was because I was so deeply unhappy. And it's your duty as a parent to recognize that, because I'm 14 years old. I have no idea what I'm doing. At least you guys have each other. I feel like I'm completely alone. And I put it on them, which, you know, isn't, in hindsight, isn't fair. And I didn't recognize that that's what I was doing. But I think that a lot of my resentment did stem from that time. Is that at all something that happened with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my parents are like the most important people in my entire life. Like I live like 30 minutes, which is like an easy drive over here. And my parents are actually from Scotland. So yeah, very, very close with them. And, you know, reflecting, we've talked about it, talked about my childhood and, you know, the self-harm in particular. They didn't know. You know, you don't know what you don't know. And that grace, you know, often isn't given to parents. And, you know, that's why I'm particularly passionate about helping educate parents on mental health, because our parents weren't educated because their experiences weren't their childhoods wouldn't have been, you know, the resources weren't there as well. So, you know, I think there's definitely the hurt from it, of more, you know, my parents didn't know how to handle it. And they put me in one therapy session and forced me to go. And then the therapist was like, well, she's not talking, this isn't going to work. Which now actually, like, that therapist, that was problematic, because at least they were like, okay, therapy, we've never had to do this before. Maybe don't use the word resentment, but I think hurt. Like, I think that's really where I come, like, where it's like you felt hurt that, you know, there wasn't that empathy, like not even empathy, but like being able to be met where you were. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, you know, if I were to have kids, which I don't think will happen, but that's what I would be most excited for, is to be able to like meet them and see them and, you know, take off that parenting hat and like connect in the way that that child needs. I know I say that now, but, you know, I imagine that's very difficult to do. So I think I wish I had that. I wish I had someone telling me that what I was going through wasn't wrong, and perhaps have someone share how they had felt that in the same way. I think I didn't feel, you know, related to in how my parents handled it, but you know, they didn't know that that's what they should do, or that they could do that, or what that would look like. So I think it's been, you know, your parents do the best job, like in a lot of instances, do the best job that they can. And they have, you know, only the tools that they have to, you know, approach these things. So, I think it's been something that we've talked about and, you know, work through now. And then even now, like when I am in like an episode these days, even at 27 with a husband, like I'll still want to go to my parents' house and like talk through them. And now they like rise to the occasion and do such an incredible job. And even like my mom, we probably talk on the phone like at least 2 times a week. And just like, we definitely like calm one another down and have that dynamic now, which I think just is like the most beautiful thing. And I just like want that for every child and parent. And I just always come back to, you know, they did the best that they could. And while that might not have been what you needed, there is, you know, that's not their fault.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Like my family is very close, and I speak to my parents like almost every day, if not every day, especially my dad. Like, we talk all the time. And there was literally periods throughout my teen years where I didn't even speak to him. Like, I feel like a lot, I was hurting so much, especially as a teenager, that it was, they always say, oh, you were always moody, you'd always snap, you'd always shout. And I know why I reacted that way. It's because I literally was on the verge of tears, like most of the time. And I felt so ashamed. Like, it was such a sense of, because you don't feel understood by anyone. So you feel like you're the weird one. And so I was just really ashamed and embarrassed to admit that anything was wrong. And so I wouldn't tell anyone, and I would just build it up inside me. But I was literally on the verge of tears all the time. And it's like, I can't talk at a normal tone right now, because if I talk normally, it's like, it's gonna come out in tears. Like, I need to shout and I need to be angry, because it's the other extreme, and that way I can just keep it hidden. And that's why I always tell parents, like, the best parenting advice I can probably give you is, it's not easy to be nice when you're unhappy. But I do think there do need to be more tools for recognizing it, because when you're in that situation as a teen or as an adult or whatever, because you feel such deep shame, it's really hard to reach out. You know, like, once the depression ended for me, or I became to see, you know, the brighter side of things, I then, that's when I started to take action, really. When you're in it, I felt such a deep sense of indifference for life in general that I just, there was no motivation to do anything. I was like, I just don't care what happens. And so it's very hard to reach out to someone when you're in it, but especially for parents with kids or with teenage kids as well, like there needs to be more education to help them look out for the signs that might indicate that although things might appear fine, they might not be, especially because there's such a contrast in generations as well. Like my parents come from a totally different generation. Like my dad comes from a rural village in the mountains in Spain. Like it was normal to like beat kids with a stick in that time. Like in contrast to what my dad had to go through, I've had like a wonderful childhood. So it probably didn't even cross his mind that there could be something wrong with going on. So yeah, like it's, I think it's definitely super important because that also helps build who that person will become. So I think especially with parents, there needs to be more education.
Mm-hmm. And like even to your comment of, I think like at least my parents thought that there had been this great event that there was like, and we had this time where when I admitted to them that I had like attempted suicide, and they were like, and this was like later, like this would have been like at 25, and they were like, well, like were you abused, did someone sexually abuse you, what happened, like what happened? Mm-hmm. And you know, I've so unfortunate that those situations do happen that lead to mental health concerns, but in some instances it's not necessarily going to be this grand event. And, you know, I like I've like extensively talked to my therapist about this where I'm like, why do, like, I have had an incredible childhood. Yes, I had that event happen, but, you know, I don't want to, and I don't, I like, I always try to discredit, you know, my trauma and, you know, compare when that isn't healthy. But I'm like, but why am I so almost like sensitive? Why does things affect me so deeply? Mm-hmm. And it's like everyone interprets and experiences life differently to varying degrees. And, you know, your child doesn't have, like, they don't have to have gone through this massive event for them to be struggling with their mental health, because each person in their own brain is equipped differently to handle and navigate life's adversities. And, you know, knowing that, and then I think that makes it easier to look for the signs, because if you're waiting, if you are waiting for something to happen to your child before then, okay, you know that they, you know, lost, you know, a relative or something. So now I'm going to watch and monitor if they're like grieving, how that's showing up. But so stop looking for or waiting for that event or thinking that that's what, I guess, triggers mental health, and knowing that, again, everyone has different abilities to navigate life. And again, that comes down to, I guess, the makeup in your brain.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you could have four different kids growing up in a household where there's domestic violence, for example, and they grow up to be completely different and experience that trauma completely differently. Like, I actually remember in one of our, it almost made me feel guilty because we had an interview with a girl called Shilpa Raj. She's from India. It was one of our episodes. She basically talks about, she comes from the, like, a really poor social class in India, and she was raised in a completely Anglo-Saxon school that they built over there. It's an organization that does great work, but she talks about how the village where she comes from, it's like extreme poverty and there are very high suicide rates. I mean, it's a place where literally people get married at like 16, 18. There's a lot of problems with alcohol because it's banned, and so it's kind of done under the radar. There's a lot of crime, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of just extreme poverty, depression, and people commit suicide. And all of the reasons for committed suicide seemed like, oh my god, this is very explicable. It's like we almost try to justify feeling a particular way, and it's like, it's, people shouldn't be, you know, feel guilty. Like, I would feel guilty for being depressed when there's another person who doesn't even have enough food to feed their child. Like, to me, it's rational for that person to be depressed. It's irrational for me to be depressed. But that's what we need to understand. Like, mental health isn't necessarily rational. It's emotional. Like you can't rationalize it. You can't quantify it. You can't say, oh, this person's is more than that person. It's like, no, like it's completely unique. And that's why there needs to be so much more awareness so that people become self-aware of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, again, I call it like the trauma Olympics, where you think, you know, you're comparing trauma, and that's not helpful for anyone. Perspective is very helpful, and coming back to what you're grateful for, and that you're grateful that you have, you know, food, a house to live in, food, and that's a beautiful thing. But gratitude alone isn't going to cure you from what you're facing. You know, I struggle with phobias, very intense phobias that are completely irrational. And I think that that's really helped me kind of understand mental health even in itself, because, you know, when I try to explain them, I'm like, rationally, I know that this is ridiculous, you know, for like, you know, not judging myself, but I know that this doesn't make any sense. But there's that part of my brain that just latches onto this. And I think, you know, even that example, like that mental health, you know, we can't rationally explain these things, and again, like you said, it's emotional, and I think that's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, exactly. And both can coexist, like you say. Like, you can rationally know one thing. Like, I can know that I'm, you know, upset about something ridiculous, but I'm allowed to be upset, and for a second, so long as I don't obviously affect anyone else, I'm allowed to sit in that feeling for a while. Like, I maybe sometimes it's just time. You need to get over it and accept it, and just let it be, and accept that this is just how you're going to feel at that particular time. This is what you're going to be afraid of, and it's not shameful.
I love that.
Sophie, thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, anyone listening, please know you are not alone, and whatever you're going through is very valid.
Yeah, and check out the Dive Through website, because there are so many excellent resources on there, and you've got such a great team of people.
Thank you. Yeah, you can find us at divethrough.com, like drive through but without the R, or in the App Store as well.
Yeah, I'll include the link in the show notes for anyone listening. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We really hope you enjoyed the episode. As always, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We love hearing from you. Bye.